Good evening, I'm Lee Hay, and welcome to a celebration of King Records tonight. The spotlight's on the five Royales from North Carolina who recorded many hits for King, including Dedicated to the One I Love, Think, and Tears of Joy. Dr. Fred Tanner, Loman Pauling, and music historian Tom McCullough recently shared some of their memories of the group with music historian Brian Powers. This evening, you'll also hear songs they recorded at King Records, plus a song from their fan Steve Cropper on this special in honor of King Records Month in Cincinnati.
My name is Tom McCullough, and I've been a fan of the Five Royales since probably the early 70s, and I'm currently retired. I've worked in music retailing for a number of years, and that's how I met my friend Taylor Doggett, with whom I worked on a number of Five Royales projects throughout the years.
Well, can you tell me how you got interested in their music?
So I kind of got into the record collecting field. I didn't immediately gravitate to the Five Royales, but I was definitely interested in R&B vocal groups. When I found out they were based out of Winston-Salem, which is about 20 miles from Greensboro, which is where I lived then and still live, and I began reading about their songs that had suggestive content, particularly Laundromat Blues and some of the other jump blues-oriented songs. They tended to have a little bit bluesier approach to vocal group harmony than a lot of the other bird groups and other smoother type doo-wop groups. It was really hard to find any Five Royales records back in those days. I used to hit the flea markets and the yard sales every weekend looking for old rock and roll and old R&B. And eventually I did come upon a couple old scratchy 78s, which were very good. That was probably the first records I heard. Radio stations I listened to in those days did not really play deep R&B like the Five Royales. But after I heard those 78s, I was determined to find better-sounding reissues or originals if I could find them. I got involved in reading a lot of magazines like the Living Blues, Cream, Fusion, even Rolling Stone, which would occasionally do features on the classic groups. I found some ads in one of them that put me on to J&F Record Special, which later morphed into Down Home Music, and then later still into Roots and Rhythm, which is still in operation. They finally started carrying one rather strange, almost quasi-bootleg title called Down Home with the Five Royales, which I ordered right away. Since I saw a Five Royales LP, I had to have it. It contained 14 of their older Apollo sides.
Well, can you give us a little bit of background on the Five Royales, you know, how they came together and where and when that all happened?
The origin of the group can be traced back to the three Price sisters in 1920s, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. They each married into the King and Pauling families, and in 1936, at the Teen Gospel Quartet, known as the Price Four, also known as the Price Singers, and also known as the Price Sisters, consists of Dorothy Pauling, Curtis Pauling, Eloise King, and Catherine King. The group was popular in local churches, but really did not travel too far out of the Winston-Salem area. After that, the Teenage Royal Sons Quintet coalesced around 1938. The original members included Loman Pauling Jr., Clarence Pauling, who later changed his name to Clarence Paul to avoid confusion with his, at the time, more famous brother. Clarence Pauling left the group in 1948 to join the gospel group Wings Over Jordan Choir, and then later on joined the Coleman Brothers gospel group. Another original member was Windsor King, who was a second cousin to the Paulings. Anthony Price, who sadly was drafted into the Marines and died in World War II. And William Samuels, who was a neighborhood friend of the others, later to become a Pauling in-law. He figures into the story later on of the Five Royals. In 1950, the gospel group Royal Sons Quintet had a photo done. And it had six individuals pictured by Loman Pauling, Johnny Holmes, Jimmy Moore, who joined in 1944, Johnny Tanner, who joined the quintet in 43 and was drafted into the military service the next year, Otto Jeffries, who joined in 1944, and Obadiah Carter, who replaced William Samuels when he was inducted into the Navy. There were other transient members. Curtis Pauling, another Pauling brother, was in, and a fellow named Garfield was also a member of the Royal Sons Quintet briefly in the 40s. The Royal Sons Quintet was a very successful traveling act, traveling into North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, West Virginia. They had three successful radio shows on Winston-Salem radio stations, WAAA, WAIR, and WSJS. They were even recording advertising jingles for their advertisers, which included Kern's Bread. They also, interestingly, played wide audiences at private functions. The gospel group was really cooking. Keep in mind, the earliest pre-recording lineups of the Royal Sons consisted of young men, many of whom were still in their teens and living with their families. They were primarily from the Pauling, Price, and King extended families. Lineups changed frequently.
Well, the Royal Sons, they got a record contract. Can you talk about when and how that happened?
Right. They were doing, of course, radio broadcasts regularly on WSJS in Winston-Salem. Bob Woodward, who was the audio engineer at that station, became their road manager. He suggested they cut a promotional acetate to pitch their work to a record label. They had sample tunes including It's Gonna Rain, I Wanna Rest So God Can Use Me on that acetate, which has never been found, unfortunately. It was sent to the Apollo label, where President Bess Berman was not terribly impressed, but Apollo producer Carl LeBeau was quite interested. LeBeau was sent to North Carolina to supervise the first Royal Sons Quintet Apollo Records session, which was held at the Freeze Auditorium at Winston-Salem State Teachers College in August 51. LeBeau was the Royal Sons' biggest supporter and advocate to Ms. Berman, who had been lukewarm at best in her assessment of the group's prospects. Their first record was Bedside of a Neighbor, backed with Journey's End, and it featured John Tanner as lead tenor, William Samuels as tenor baritone, Jimmy Moore, baritone, tenor, and falsetto, Otto Jeffries bass, and Loman Pauling doing double duty as bass vocal and guitarist. And they were also accompanied with the longtime sidekick to the Five Royals, Royal Abbott, on piano. That was good enough to get them a second release. They were brought up to New York for the second release, which was Come Over Here and Let Nothing Separate Me From His Love.
Come over here, the table is free. Feast of the Lord is going on. Gonna drink from the fountain, never tire. Trouble's over. By and by, come on over here, where the table is spread. Feast of the Lord is still going on. We're gonna drink from the fountain, never tire. Trouble's over. By and by,
come on over here.
They got signed as a gospel group, but then they started recording secular music. How did that come about?
WSJS sound engineer Bob Woodward pulled the stint as the road manager in a position that had been previously held by John Tanner and Otto Jeffries. Jeffries continued in that role when the group morphed into the Five Royals later on. Carl LeBeau, the guy from Apollo Records, so high on the Royal Sons, made sure that the Royal Sons contract had stipulated they were also available to cut secular material if the label so desired. So Berman did press them to do that. They immediately recorded a pair of Pauling compositions that were very impressive and didn't really sound like anything currently riding the R&B charts at the time. Almost immediately, their efforts in the secular field had great success. Baby Don't Do It hit number one on the Billboard R&B in January 53. Help Me Somebody, number one R&B in May 53. Crazy, 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 number five Billboard R&B, also in 5:53. Too Much Loving, number four Billboard R&B in August 53. And I Do, number six Billboard R&B in February 54. So a very auspicious start for them in the secular field.
Now, they eventually ended up signing up with King Records. Did you have any information on how that came about?
Yeah, they were kind of actually poached from Apollo to go to King because Carl LeBeau was kind of really hedging his bets. He was managing the Five Royals on Apollo, and he just accepted a new A&R position, King. He immediately put together this deal on the King subsidiary Deluxe for the Loman Pauling Country Homes record. He did two records, which were both penned by Pauling with his writing partner, Eunice Davis. J. Taylor Doggett, they had been laying the groundwork for the eventual spiriting away of the entire group to King in July 54 amidst a barrage of lawsuits that led to their first early King releases, one of which was Monkey Hips and Rice, recorded June 54 in Cincinnati, released in 10-54, based on a remark made by a jokester in a restaurant on the alleged delicacy, Monkey Hips and Rice.
Geneva, call me on the telephone this morning.
Wah, wah, wah.
She told me that she had something good to give me.
Wah, wah, wah.
I couldn't hardly wait to get to my Geneva.
Wah, wah, wah.
And if I told you what she had for me, boy, would you believe me? It was monkey hips and rice, monkey hips and rice, monkey hips and rice, monkey hips and rice.
Another suggestive tune, Schoolgirl, coming from an 11-1854 Cincinnati session. Well, these were good records, but they were not really racing to the top of the charts like the Apollo records had done. Another of their early efforts on King was Right Around the Corner, released January 56. It was recorded at Belltone Studios in New York, which was a familiar site for the Five Royals, as they recorded quite a few of their Apollo hits at that studio. Right Around the Corner was interestingly also put out by King by their rockabilly artist Boyd Bennett at the same time. In fact, the same ad in the trade paper was pushing both the Five Royals version and Boyd Bennett's version. So they were off to a good start at King, but nothing to the extent of the hot streak they had on Apollo.
57, though, they actually probably recorded the most famous songs. Can you talk about the sessions in 57?
Tears of Joy was kind of a departure for Five Royals. It was really the closest thing they ever did to a true doo-wop song. It cracked the chart big time, breaking into the top 10 at number 9. Tears of Joy was well-suited to Eugene Tanner's vocal style. He had a much smoother delivery than his brother John, and then right on the heels of that, Think, which was really a showcase for Loman Pauling's guitar work. Johnny Tanner was in the middle of it all, singing his heart out, and the Royals were clapping and chanting simultaneously. Pauling sealed the ending with two power chords, leaving no doubt that the song had come to its conclusion.
Tears of joy. Fire love.
their most influential song of all time was dedicated to the one I love, which was never a big chart hit for the Five Royales, but picked up by the Shirelles, it became a worldwide smash, and to the point that the executives at King went back and overdubbed some stuff on the Five Royales first, adding some female voices to make their record sound more like the Shirelles cover version.
You mentioned Loman's guitar playing. Can you talk about its influence?
Yeah, definitely. Loman Pauling was not to be outdone by other 50s guitarists such as Chuck Berry or Bo Diddley or any other guitar slingers of the era. He was the picture of cool, perfectly creased slacks, matching jacket, processed hair, and a Gibson Les Paul hanging down to his knees oftentimes, his fingers blazing up and down the fretboard, even playing with his feet. His playing style has prompted some to call him the Daddy of Funk. He studied under one of the 50s greatest session guitarists, Mickey Guitar Baker, who played on the earlier Five Royales records. James Brown absolutely worshipped the Five Royales and Pauling's funky guitar playing. It's a shame that when Mick Jagger produced that James Brown biopic several years ago, he failed to elaborate on the Five Royales' connection to Brown, especially since Jagger himself had also covered Five Royales soon. Steve Cropper of Booker T and the MGs, and veteran of many great sessions for other artists, is probably Pauling's greatest cheerleader. Eric Clapton and Jimi Hendrix were no doubt also influenced, and Pauling regularly gets votes on the greatest guitar player lists and trade magazines.
Say it.
Come on, baby.
Say it.
Please.
Say it.
Even
if it hurts me.
Don't try so hard to get along with me. I don't want to where you don't want to be. And if there's anything you want to tell me, why don't you
say it?
My name is Loman Darrell Pauling. I'm the son of Loman Pauling, who was the main songwriter and guitar player for the Five Royales. He basically molded the group because he gave everybody their parts, and basically it was about him. They were probably one of the best unsung heroes of the R&B era. In fact, what I've been told by a lot of people, they started it all. In fact, Otis Williams from the Temptations said that if it wasn't for Five Royals, there would have been a Temptation.
As I understand, you have a very musical family. Your grandfather was a gospel singer and your uncles. Can you talk a little bit about different family members and their musical abilities?
Well, they started off, like I said, my grandfather, with a gospel group called the Royal Sons. And my two uncles, my father, and my aunt, she had a separate group. In fact, I think my grandfather and left the group when he got older. When the Royal Sons went to Apollo to record a gospel album, and then they came up there and they decided they wanted to do R&B. Clarence Pauling, who changed his name to Clarence Paul, who was my uncle, he went to Motown and ended up being Stevie Wonder's mentor and his first manager. And in fact, he wrote a lot of songs with Stevie Wonder. In fact, my uncle wrote Fingertips. My other uncle, Curtis Pauling, he was more like a comedian. He worked for Shirley Caesar, a gospel singer for Lord knows how long. He was a bus driver and confidant. The family has a lot of musical ties.
Well, I want to talk about your dad's guitar playing. Is there any stories about how he got into playing guitar?
My father's first guitar was made by my grandfather. It was a shoebox. with a stick and a string. That's how he really started playing the guitar. And in fact, it was said that my Uncle Clarence and my dad did a talent show when they was in Bluefield, West Virginia. And they won. And the school they went to didn't have a bathroom. And what they did was donate the money so the school could get a bathroom.
Well, with your family, you guys had like a gospel group, and you guys were based out of Winston-Salem. Were they playing like a circuit or something?
Yes. They had a gospel circuit here. In fact, I stayed across the street from a school. And there was times when they have concerts there. And I wasn't really old enough to remember most of it. But you know, they would tell me how they had Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers. We used to go over there, the Five Blind Boys. And all of them used to come back to the house. In fact, they put out a couple of songs, gospel songs out.
They're from Winston-Salem. How did they get signed to a record label in New York?
Like I said, they're doing a gospel circuit here. And somebody caught their eye, because they used to be on the radio. And somebody heard them, and they took them to Apollo. And they wanted, like I said, they wanted to record a gospel album.
They started out as the Royal Sons. And they
Royal
became,
Sons.
Then they got signed to Apollo Records in New York as a gospel group, but then they switched to R&B. Did you ever hear stories of how that happened or why that happened?
Yes, the record executives heard them, and they persuaded them to switch to R&B. It was the executive at Apollo. And when they did that, they kept that gospel sound, which switched to R&B. But the thing that people don't realize is they did the crossover from gospel to R&B and took that influence 3 years before Ray Charles got credited with doing it. But they did it first. In fact, they did a lot of things first.
Yeah, they're finally getting recognized as a group that were doing a lot of that crossover using gospel vocals, and there's so many singers who've claimed influence by the Fivrells, like James Brown and Hank Ballard, and you were mentioning Otis Williams from the Temptations.
They really were ahead of their time. You know, like I said, James Brown patterned his first group after the Fivrells. And my dad, who was playing guitar, had the low strap, and we fram, you know, they say Chuck Berry to do the duck walk. My dad was doing that way before Chuck Berry did. But Chuck Berry got the credit for it. Eugene Tanner used to slide across the stage on his knees. He did that before Jackie Wilson did it. But they didn't get any credit for that.
Can you talk about the different members that were in the Fivrells? There were two pairs of brothers and some other guys. I think you knew some of those guys, didn't you?
I knew all of them. Start off, it was my dad, Otto Jeffries, William Samuels, who was my uncle, he married my mother's sister. It was June Tanner. Then William Samuels left, and Donnell came on, Donnell Tanner. And then Obadiah Carter got older, and Jimmy Moore came on. But the real core of the Fivrells, when they were really doing the R&B, was Jimmy Moore, Obadiah Carter, Eugene Tanner, Donnell Tanner, and my dad.
I think John Tanner, he was the lead singer early on, and then I think Eugene was doing some lead vocals later, too.
Donnell Tanner started out doing lead, then Eugene came, because Eugene sung Dedicated When I Love. That was basically the core of the group. Those were the main ones.
Now, we always talk about your dad's guitar player, but he also sang, didn't he?
Yes, but he really only led two songs, Too Much and a Little Bit, and Do Unto You. He had that bass baritone. You know, he didn't lead that much.
They had several hits with Apollo before they switched over to King. But, you know, it was at King where your dad's guitar playing really took a change. I mean, on the Apollo recordings, you don't really hear his guitar, but it was at King that he really, on like Dedicated to the One I Love and Think, is when you start hearing his guitar playing.
Yeah, when he was doing gospel, the guitar was more prevalent. You heard it more on the gospel songs. Like I said, when he went to Apollo, the sax players were all the rage, so... And like I said, when they went to King, they want to distinguish themselves to be different. So guitar started taking over.
And, you know, a lot of those recordings that they did at King with that guitar playing, I mean, that was a big influence on Steve Cropper, who was from Stax, and Eric Clapton. I was wondering if you've ever talked to those guys.
Yes, I talked to Steve Cropper. In fact, we talked a long time at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I also talked to Jimmy Vaughn. They don't know, but, you know, he sat at the table and told us that my dad influenced them, too. And I found out a lot there that my dad influenced Jimi Hendrix, Somebody told me that Bootsy Collins could be with James Brown. There's a few other people. Like I said, Chuck Berry took the low strap and stuff from him. So he influenced a lot of people.
I wanted to talk a little bit about his songwriting. Do you know how he got into songwriting, how old he was when he started to write songs?
I have no idea about that. You know, I used to hear him practice downstairs. I don't know how old he was, but he had to be young because he wrote some gospel songs. And he was young when they started off as a gospel group. He was in his late teens, early 20s when they started off as a gospel group.
Did he just have one guitar or did he have several guitars? Do you remember?
I only remember two. No, he had more than that. A couple were stolen. And we had a flood in our basement and one was destroyed. They were practiced downstairs, but they wouldn't let me really come down. Because, you know, they'd be out there drinking and stuff. And I was shielded from that.
So is any of his guitar or any of them around anymore?
No. In fact, they really weren't popular back then, especially when he died. I mean, when my dad died, the paper, he had a little article about, about the size of a matchbook. And they even spelled his name wrong.
Your father died relatively young. He was in his 40s.
He was 47. He's 47. In fact, he died on my mother's birthday.
And I think he was in New York at the time, right?
He was in New York.
What was he doing in New York at that time? This is like the early 70s, I think.
It was 73. When the group broke up, he stayed in New York. Him and my uncle still tried to kickstart the music career. And they had little things going. So he was up there, and he was working at a synagogue. He passed in church. He passed in the synagogue. But, you know, he would come home and, you know, take me to the beach and all this stuff. But
did he have a heart condition or something?
He was epileptic. And depression, because he's depressed because of music. The way the record company were doing him, he was depressed about that. And he started drinking, and he died from a cirrhosis of the liver and epilepsy.
Did you get to see him perform live at all?
Yes. I saw him at the Apollo. That's the only place they would let me go to see. I couldn't go to clubs, but I saw him at the Apollo.
Now, was that with the Five Royals, or was that another project that he was...
That was with the Five Royals.
So what are your memories of that show?
The only thing I remember is saying, I want my daddy. I want my mother. Other than that, I think Little Richard was on the program. I was scared of him because of his hair. He just had some big processes. And he had the makeup on and stuff. I was scared of him. I remember that part. And other than that, I remember them just playing and everybody screaming. I'm enjoying myself.
Since your dad passed away in the early 70s, since that time, there's been more efforts made to sort of remember the Firells and to understand their importance. Your hometown in Winston-Salem, they've done stuff. Can you talk a little bit about stuff that's been done over the years?
Well, they've gotten the North Carolina Music Hall of Fame Award, North Carolina Heritage Award. My father has received the North Carolina Songwriters Award. They've been honored by the city a couple of times. They have a street named after them here in the city. In a couple of months, they will have a star in front of the convention center downtown. And right now, we got paperwork in, trying to get in to make the house where I'm at now. It's a historical site since this is where they used to practice and so forth. And, of course, you know, we got the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They had numerous articles written about them here. But even with all of that, they still haven't got the public recognition that they deserve. People here still know who they are, and we still have radio stations here who have no clue. Because I talked to one of the station managers here at a local station. It's a black station. And I asked her, you know, about Dedicated One I Love. She said she never heard the song. So even though they're now getting the recognition, it's not like it should be.
You were at the Rock Hall when they got inducted.
Yes, I accepted the award for my father.
Can you talk about that day?
Oh, man, that was phenomenal. That's a day I never forget. People that were there, I mean, I got a chance to meet, like, Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr. Bill Withers and I had talked a long time. And I also got a long conversation with Paul Schaefer, Jimmy Vaughn, Oka Ono. I mean, those were some of the nicest people you ever want to meet, man. You think that they'd be high and mighty, they were not. They were really down to earth. See, I'd already been the president of Stevie Wonder because Stevie Wonder used to come to the house. Clarence was his manager. But the best thing that came out of that was I got a chance to talk to people who really knew my dad's music. I talked to Bill Withers. He was telling me how he was in the Navy, and he had my dad's songs and stuff in his locker. I talked to Jimmy Ray Vaughan, Jimmy Vaughan, who was telling me about how him and his brother used to get my dad's records and try to copy his guitar style. I talked to Steve Cropper, and he really talked to him, man. They really had praise. In fact, he did an album of my dad's music. He said that long strap, he said he snuck in to see him play one day at a club. So after he seen my dad play, he went home and got two belts and made a strap so he could play his guitar low like that. And Paul Schaefer, he was on the committee for the Rock Hall of Fame. He said every year the Five Warriors name came up. But for some reason, everybody else, even though they influenced all these people before them, everybody jumped over them and took presents. He said he didn't understand it. So they were glad they was in. And the love that these musicians gave my father and the group was out of this world.
Steve Cropper, I think he was part of the induction ceremony, and he also put an album out covering all Five Royal songs.
Yes, yes, he did. He inducted the Five Royals. And that was the night that I'll never forget.
All the Five Royals are passed on, but the family members made it up to the Rock Hall, too, right?
Yeah.
For the ceremony.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was five of us made it on stage, but we had more of the audience. Each member was represented.
And they got inducted in?
It was 2015.
Your mom, I guess she must have a lot of stories of when he was on the road, right, when he wasn't around.
She told me a lot. Some of that stuff I can't repeat, but they had some interesting stories. Almost being arrested and... One of the things that I do remember is when they used to come in off the road, I stayed across the street from a high school. And when that station wagon would pull up, the yard used to be full of kids, mainly girls. I mean, we have a house full. All the neighbors and stuff would come down. I mean, this was the place to be when that station wagon came up. And when they would be downstairs practicing sometimes, I had some friends of mine. They used to practice in our basement. Try to sneak down there on the outside, try to look through the windows and see them practice. So they had to start blocking the windows. And she told me about them traveling. You know, because they traveled in a station wagon. And a couple of times she had to drive through the blizzard and the snow and all that stuff. You know, they told me about how hard they'd be on the road sometimes. They'd be hungry and couldn't fight. Certain places they couldn't eat, you know, and stuff. So they had to eat potted meat and... Bologna while they're traveling. It was a hard road.
Did you talk to the other members? I mean, they stayed in Winston-Salem, I think. I mean, your dad stuck with for a musical career until he died, but I think the other guys ended up getting into other things other than music.
Yes, all of them came back, and they got jobs. And I used to talk to them all the time. John L. Tanner, when I was trying to think of something to do to honor the group, he was kept telling me, don't honor the group, just honor my dad. But, you know, I couldn't do that. But see, John L. Tanner wouldn't tell me too much because once he got back, he left that side alone. He didn't even talk about it. He was a Christian and was all about Christianity. He wasn't nothing about no R&B. And in fact, the last time they sung as a group was with the North Carolina Heritage Award, and they did a gospel song.
They did a little reunion, like, at least three of the remaining members. Were you there right. for that event?
No, I wasn't there for that. But before they did that, we did a photo shoot. It was the four members and me. I took my dad's spot with the guitar in the middle.
Yeah, I've seen that photo because it's part of a great box set that came out just a couple of years ago of all the Five Royal recordings. And I think that's, I am hoping, will help people discover their music.
It has helped some people. And plus, I have a Five Royal page on Facebook. And... that is doing very well. I think I have close to 2,000 people now. But most of their recognition is coming from overseas, they really like the Five Royals. I mean, I'm talking about Ukraine, England, Sweden. They pours in. They send me messages. I can't read it because I can't speak their language, but they're really into it.
Yeah, I was talking to a gentleman, Jay Taylor Doggett down there.
Yes.
And he was telling me he did a lot of research over the years and how hard it was to find their recordings.
It was. That's one thing that disturbed my dad. When I was 15, I started playing the sax. And we had a little group, and he really did not want me to go that route. He told me because all the backbiting and conniving stuff that was going on, the drugs, the homosexuality, he didn't want me to do that. He said, well, my personality, he know I couldn't take it. And he was about right, because I'm a free-hearted person, and they would have ran over me. But, you know, that's one thing that led to his death, I believe. That's my opinion, I believe. We have no film footage of them. We've been trying to find some, but we can't find nothing.
I read somewhere they were on two TV shows. I forget what they were now, but people are, on the lookout for that now.
We reached out to them, and my cousin, Karen Scales, over there, Carla, is her father. She reached out to one of the stations, and they said that they would try, because the station bought by somebody else and stuff. So we're still trying to run that down.
Yeah, it'd be great to have footage of your dad playing. That would be amazing.
Yes, it would.
Do you have a favorite recording of your father's?
I have two. One being thing, because I like the guitar part of it. The other one is Dedicated One I Love, because that song was written to my mother. From my understanding, Johnny Altano told me that they were out of town. So he had just talked to my mom's, and he wrote that song on the back of an envelope. And when he came home, she told me that they played it, and he told her, this is for you. And Dad always have a special place in my heart.
This is dedicated to the one I love. While I'm away from you, my baby, I know it's hard for you, my baby, because it's hard for me, my baby, but the darkest hours is just before day. Each night before you go to bed, my baby, whisper a little prayer for me, my baby, and let's tell all the stars above that this is dedicated to the one I love.
Life can never be exactly like we want it to be,
but I can be satisfied just knowing you love me.
But there's one thing I want you to do, especially for me,
and it's something that everybody needs. Each night
mother passed. She was in the hospital, and it was in 2013. we sat there, and before they put on life support, she was telling me that no matter what I did, she wanted to make sure that the group stayed relevant, that people would know about the Five Warriors and my dad. And I sat back there, you know, and I started thinking about what I could do to do that, you know, because I had no clue how to do it. And when she passed, I really sat back and said, man, I better do something, because anybody knew my mother knew that she told me to do something, it's in my best interest to do it. And I didn't want to wake up one morning and see her sitting at the foot of my bed, bless me out, because I hadn't did anything. I sat back and I prayed on that thing, and the next thing I know, Lisa O'Donnell, who had did a couple of stories on us for Wall Street Journal, in fact, she did a story on my mom when she died. December 2014, I was laying in the bed. She called me at 5 o'clock in the morning and told me they're in. And I'm saying, in what? They were in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And that started everything rolling. And all that I can say is, thank you, Jesus, because now my mama's wish is being fulfilled. And now you're calling. I got other people calling. A guy from PBS came and did a tour of the house. So, you know, a little prayer goes a long ways. My dad started in gospel, and thank God it's sticking with me.
Hello, I'm Fred Tanner, the brother of Eugene and Johnny Tanner, who sang with Five Royals. They did a lot of recording back in the 50s. They were brothers who came from a religious background. My mother and father were highly religious people, and most of their training in the family's training was in gospel music.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about that. Your family, I guess they were pretty well known in North Carolina as a gospel group, the Tanner family, weren't they?
Yes, we were. And as far as I can remember, I was perhaps between 6 and 8 years old back then. My dad was a singer. He sang and had a lot of following in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia, by the way. I'm told he had the first African-American singer to have a commercially sponsored program in North Carolina. So he came on the radio every week, and I'm told that people flocked to the radio to hear him sing.
I know your one brother, Johnny, was part of that. Was both of your brothers part of the Tanner family gospel group?
No, Johnny actually was not with the family singers.
Okay.
Eugene was. By the time we developed, Johnny had left home. I mean, I don't remember him living in the home at all. It was about 12, 13 years, the age difference between me and Johnny.
Your brother Johnny sang most of the lead vocals for the group. How did he get involved with the Five Royals?
Well, you know, they originally started with the three Paulings. There was Clarence Curtis and Lawman. There was a fellow named William Samuels who sang with them, and Otto Jeffries. And the Paulings were replaced by James Moore and Johnny and Obadiah Carter. I guess they joined the group around maybe the early 50, 1950 perhaps. And they sang in churches. They were a local gospel quintet, and they were really, really good. So I remember hearing them sing. My brothers, on the other hand, there were four of us left at home. Eugene, that was Pernell and David, and of course myself. And we formed a quartet, and we traveled around from church to church with my dad and my mother. And we sang gospel music in church. Of course, a lot of the training was done by Johnny, who would leave the Royal Sons, and he came back to teach us various songs that they had done. Of course, we sang in the same kinds of settings with them.
And at that time, the group was called the Royal Sons.
Correct.
Did you ever hear a story of why they had that name?
No, I never got the background of how they became the Royal Sons.
Now, the Royal Sons, they got signed to Apollo Records in New York City, and I guess you were probably a teenager at that point. Do you remember when that was happening?
Yeah, that happened in the early 50s. I was probably in the 7th or 8th grade, and they were signed, and they changed their name from the Royal Sons to the Five Royals. And I remember hearing them on the radio, and it was a big deal back then.
Well, what was their first big hit?
Baby Don't Do It. That was the first one I can remember, the big hit that they had.
Now, that was a secular song because they were originally signed as a gospel group, but then they did secular music. I was wondering what your family thought of when they were doing music that wasn't gospel music.
Well, you know, there was some concern from my mom and my dad. Of course, we brothers, we didn't mind at all. But my mom and my dad, being highly religious people, kind of had reservations about them doing it. But they were also very liberal in their thinking. And so they knew it was an occupation or a job, so they went along with it.
And I guess they spent a lot of time on the road. Would your brother ever tell you stories about the road?
Well, they did, at my urging, because they never came and volunteered much to me. But I would ask them questions. Where have you been? How is Florida? And, you know, things like that. I had most of my conversations with Eugene after he joined the group much later. You know, he was sort of matter-of-factly, you know, he was, oh, yeah, we went to Florida, you know, went to Miami. And he wouldn't say much about it. And I would say, how was it? And, you know, it was just another conversation. He was very casual about it.
Well, I know you were still pretty young when they were getting popular. Did you get to see them perform live anywhere?
Oh, yeah. That was much later, around the late 50s. I did perform with them. At a dance, the nightclub in Greensboro. I was playing in a house band at that time. And a lot of performers would come through. I remember being the house band for Benny King and Joe Tex, Chuck Jackson. And, of course, they all knew the Five Royals. And they would talk about them and tell me things about them. And they would tell me how they felt about them and the influences that they had on them.
What was that club that you were the house band of in Greensboro?
Oh, there were two clubs in Greensboro. One was the El Rocco, and the other was the Carlotta Supper Club.
Would there be a place in Winston-Salem that bands like that could play, or was it more Greensboro that had?
It was more Greensboro back then.
Well, can you tell us a little bit what their show was like?
It was an exciting show, you know, pretty much what you saw with James Brown. They had dance routines and choreography, but it was not smooth as the Temptations. But, you know, they had things that they did on stage to enhance what they were seeing.
And how were they dressed? What was their stage uniforms like?
They had several uniforms, and all of them were the same color, the same shoes, the same, everything the same. But they had many, many uniforms. I would see a lot of them when they were not performing, when they would come home.
Do you know if any of that stuff is still around, any of those outfits?
I don't think so. I don't know about their kids. You know, they may have had something, especially Johnny's children may have had something that he wore.
Now, your brother Johnny did a lot of the lead vocals on a lot of those recordings, but then your brother Eugene also joined the group, and he did some leads. I was wondering if you could sort of compare their vocal styles. What songs would Gene sing lead, and what was Johnny? Was there a pattern to that?
Well, you know, Johnny did most of the up-tempo. He had a more gospel influence in his voice than Eugene did. Eugene had a smoother voice, more lyrical, and Johnny had a gospel, more like David Ruffin, you know, that kind of church voice when you compare the two. But Johnny did some ballads, too, and he could sing both ways. Eugene did not show as much gospel in his singing as Johnny did.
You know, you mentioned James Brown. James Brown is, you know, said the Five Royals were influence on him, and Hank Ballard. A lot of the vocalists have said that. And I was wondering, what do you think they heard in your brother's singing, you know, their vocals, that they found something that they want to imitate?
You know, I think that before they came on the scene, I sort of think of it as a bel canto kind of singing before they came on, you know, pretty, nice, beautiful singing. And I remember hearing Sonny Till, I think it was the Orioles, and Clyde McFadden, and those singers were singing very, very lyrical, pretty voice, nice lyrical voice. Well, when Johnny came on, he brought that gospel church background with him. And I think a lot of the singers, of course, have that today. That's the soul part of the singing. And I think that's probably what Hank Ballard and maybe James Brown heard. They had styles pretty similar. Their backgrounds were the same. So I think that early on, the lead singers for R&B might have suppressed that church background. Lou Rawls, for instance, sang with the Pilgrim Travelers. And I think Sam Cooke was with the Soul Stirrers. And I remember hearing a lot of the gospel recordings that Sam Cooke did lead on with the Soul Stirrers. And when he went over to secular music, his style didn't change much. You know, You Send Me was reminiscent of some of the gospel things that he had led on with the Soul Stirrers.
Right. And but your brothers were kind of, Johnny in particular, were doing that early to mid-50s.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was the influence, I believe. because it wasn't popular to sing, to bring that emotional, soul, natural church kinds of gospel styles to R&B.
Your brothers were singers. I mean, what were they like as live performers?
They had a show similar to what maybe James Brown would have had, you know, a lot of motion, a lot of movement, a lot of dancing. And of course, Loman Paulin, you know, he was a show all to himself with his guitar playing. You know, he would drop it below his knees and play. You know, he would not play in the conventional way that most guitar players were playing back then. So that was a show, you know, just within itself.
Well, when they were on the road, your brothers, they were the vocalists, and then there were a couple of vocalists, and then Pauline was the guitar player. Did they have a traveling musician, like a drummer, with them, or did they just have that when they were on the road, they would pick somebody up in a town to play?
Well, no, they had a band that traveled with them. I don't think they did too many jobs where they picked up local musicians.
Your brothers had some hits with Apollo, and then they had later on had hits with King Records. How successful did they feel at the time?
Well, you know, I think at some points they may have felt at some points in their career very successful and perhaps saw a few dollars. But I know that just like most musicians back then, most groups like that, they had problems with royalty payments and record companies. And that was the norm. You know, musicians never got what they really deserved back then.
Well, they continued on other labels into the 60s, but I guess by the mid-60s, the band broke up, and I was wondering, do you remember when that happened and why?
Yeah, I think it was just a matter of time when they felt, look, I don't want to do this anymore. They just got tired of the road. I think Johnny left, I think it was in 1963 or so. Eugene stayed out a little bit longer. I think it wasn't too much later that he came off the road, too. I just think it was a matter of being worn out there, the Chitlin Circuit, as they used to call it. It was kind of rough.
Did they continue to do any kind of music after the band ended? What did they end up doing career-wise?
Eugene didn't. Johnny joined the church. He did a lot of singing in the church. You know, just changed his whole life around and devoted himself to one of the choirs and singing in church.
What did Eugene do?
He didn't do much singing. He just got a job and lived like an average guy, you know.
Well, Winston-Salem, over the years, had kind of made efforts to honor the Five Royals. And, like, there was a street sign, I think. And
yes, there is a street name for them. There are a lot of proclamations. And, of course, they were inducted into the North Carolina Hall of Fame. And they did. So they received a cultural award in Raleigh. Before Johnny and Eugene passed, they did that.
So they were around for some of that. How did they react to that, those kind of things, that kind of effort?
It's hard to say. You know, they never showed a lot of excitement about that kind of thing, but they were happy, I'm sure, and honored to have been awarded the North Carolina Cultural Award. And they did a little performance at that award ceremony. You know, they just got a couple of the guys together. I think they did a gospel piece, if I can remember.
I had read somewhere, and maybe this is wrong information, but Johnny didn't want to sing any secular music anymore. He just would only sing gospel.
Yeah, he was hesitant about doing any secular music after he came back off the road.
Now, all the Firewells have passed away, but finally, just in 2015, they were finally recognized by the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Did you make it to that ceremony?
Yes, I did. In fact, I think they had two failures. They had attempted to get them in earlier, but they had had two occasions where they weren't. And they finally got in 2015. And actually, I did the acceptance speech for the group.
Can you talk a little bit about that night?
Oh, I was trying to convey what they would have said, imagining that they were there and how they would have felt about it. So, you know, that's not the easiest thing to do. But we expressed our appreciation.
If someone hadn't heard of the Five Royals, how could you describe why they're important to American music?
They influenced the soul singers who came after them. I hear a lot of them in David Ruffin and Temptations. And James Brown, of course, the Midnighters, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding. I think they were probably among the first performers who brought that style to R&B. So I think their contribution is that they influenced so many performers who came after them.
Do you have a favorite recording?
Well, there are two or three that I like. There's one recording that I don't think anybody's ever heard. It was called Standing in the Shadows, and it was a piece that Eugene did the lead on it. And that was late. It might have been produced in the 60s, perhaps 50s, or late 50s or 60s, but I really did like that production that they did on that piece. Then, of course, you know, the popular ones, Dedicated to the One I Love and Think, they're my favorites.
Well, I was standing, standing in the shadows, waiting for you to come home, wondering where in the world you'd been. Yes, I was standing, standing in the shadows, waiting, waiting all alone, when I saw you in the arms of my best friend. Well, I was standing, standing in the shadows, watching while you held him so tight, listening to the words that broke my heart. Yes, I was standing, standing in the shadows, watching when you kissed him goodnight, listening till you tear my dreams apart.
Thanks for listening to this special about the Five Royales in honor of Cincinnati's celebration of King Records in September. I'd like to thank music historian Brian Powers, as well as Andy Balterman, Elaine Spears, and Dave Sherman for their technical support. You'll find a link to more information about the Five Royales, as well as the many King Records events the rest of this month at WVXU.org. I'm Lee Hay, and you're listening to 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford.